July the 22nd, 1946, Jerusalem, early afternoon. A massive explosion has destroyed a large part of the King David Atoll. 91 people die in the blast. It's the deadliest attack so far on the British administration in Palestine. It's the world's first major terrorist attack since World War II. But who are the people behind the outrage? July the 22nd, 1946, Jerusalem. The King David Atoll has just been devastated by a huge bomb, killing a great number of people and wrecking a large part of the building. The hotel is the headquarters of the British administration in Palestine. But the Jews want to get the British out and establish a homeland of their own, Israel. And some of them are prepared to go to any length to achieve their aim. Even if it involves the slaughter of innocent people, as it did in the attack on the King David Atoll. Most of the 91 people killed in the blast are civilians, and ironically, 17 of them are Jews. 2 days later, a shadowy group known as the Irgun claim responsibility for the outrage. In their defense, they say they'd issued a warning 22 minutes before the blast, but the British didn't respond and failed to evacuate the building. So, alleges the Irgun, the loss of life rests squarely with the British. But the British furiously deny receiving a warning, branding the Irgun as a gang of lying, murderous terrorists. The outrage is condemned by a great many Jews themselves. The Irgun sprang into life in the early 1930s. As a hardline extremist offshoot of the Haganah, a paramilitary organization founded to protect Palestinian Jews from Arab attacks on outlying settlements and farms. At the time, Palestine is administered by Britain under a League of Nations mandate. The British had ruled Palestine since 1917, when their troops marched into Jerusalem and threw out the Turks, who had taken Germany's side during World War I. This marks the beginning of the end of the Ottoman Empire, which has held sway in the Middle East for hundreds of years. It also heralds a great push for the restoration of the ancient Kingdom of Israel, not just by Jews already living in Palestine, but by thousands of other Jews scattered throughout the world. And when the League of Nations mandate comes into effect 6 years later, Jews start flooding back to the place they regard as their rightful home. The Holy Land. This is greatly resented by Palestinian Arabs, and it's not long before Jewish settlers, particularly those living outside the urban areas, are subject to random attacks. But the violence does nothing to halt the flow of immigrants, and by the start of World War II in 1939, the British, alarmed at the number of Jews arriving in Palestine, have already started turning many of the refugee ships back. This infuriates the Haganah, but they agree to suspend their opposition to the British until Nazi Germany has been defeated. The Irgun also takes the same line. Since Adolf Hitler became Chancellor in 1933, Jews living in Germany had been persecuted relentlessly. And although it would not be until the end of the war in Europe in May 1945 that the true horror of the Holocaust is revealed, Jews resisting British rule in Palestine knew that Hitler represented a threat to their very survival. So he has to be defeated at all costs, even if this means siding with Britain, the long-standing occupying power. However, not all Jews felt the same. For instance, Avraham Stern, founder of what became known as the Stern Gang, an Irgun splinter group, favored joining forces with the Axis powers. First, he courted Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, hoping that if Italy overran the Middle East, Mussolini would be happy to see a Jewish state set up in Palestine. But when Mussolini lost out to the British in North Africa, Stern now turned his attention to Hitler. He thought that if he collaborated with Germany, and Germany won the war, Hitler would expel the British from Palestine, thus enabling Stern to establish a Nazi-style totalitarian Jewish state. Meanwhile, Stern and his gang tried to raise funds by carrying out a series of violent bank robberies in Tel Aviv. The British, who regard the Stern gang as no more than a bunch of terrorist criminals, especially when they kill three policemen, now go after their leaders with a vengeance. Stern himself is eventually cornered in February 1942 and shot dead. The authorities now mop up many of his fellow terrorists, one of whom is Yitzhak Shamir, who will later become Prime Minister of Israel. But the Stern gang, now known as the Lehi, are still determined to get the British out of Israel. On November 4, 1944, they carry out their most audacious act to date, when Lord Moyne, a prominent British politician, is assassinated during an attack on his car in Cairo, Egypt. Moyne, a member of the famous Irish Guinness family, had just been appointed Minister Resident, the highest-ranking British politician in the region. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who had long supported the idea of a Jewish state, was outraged. Leading Jews are also shot. Dr. Chaim Weizmann, head of the Zionist Congress and later the first president of Israel, called upon the Jews in Palestine to cast out the terrorists and refuse them any assistance. After they'd shot Lord Moyne, his assassins, two Palestinian Jews, were seized by an angry mob and handed over to the police. On January the 11th, 1945, they're sentenced to death and hanged 2 months later. But the Lehi are undeterred and begin to step up their campaign to oust the British. However, a great many Jews are sick of the violence. They know it's not getting them anywhere. Encouraged by David Ben-Gurion, the leading member of the Jewish Agency, informers now hand over the names of around 700 suspected terrorists to the British authorities. These include not only members of the Lehi, or Stern Gang, but also those in the Irgun. Since December 1943, the Irgun has been led by Menachem Begin. He will later become Prime Minister of Israel in May 1977, but now he has a £2,000 price on his head. Meanwhile, another leading Zionist, Golda Meir, also condemns the terrorist organizations, describing them as fascists. Both she and Ben-Gurion are determined to help the British stamp out the Irgun and the Lehi. They know the British government will never agree to the formation of a separate Jewish state while the violent extremists hold sway. Following Hitler's suicide a week earlier, Germany surrenders unconditionally on May the 7th, 1945. Now the Jews, many of whom had fought bravely on the side of the Allies, hope that it won't be long before the victors agree to the formation of a Jewish state within Palestine. But it's not high on the British agenda, especially as the country is now led by a new Labour government headed by Clement Attlee. The end of the war sees hundreds of thousands of Jews in Europe desperate to make their way to Palestine. But the British are still reluctant to relax the strict immigration rules. Now they not only prevent refugee ships docking, but they send their occupants back across the Mediterranean to the displaced persons camps in Germany from which many of them had fled in the first place. The Irgun and the Lehi respond by stepping up their campaign, calling for Palestinian Jews to take up arms against the British. They carry out random acts of sabotage, including blowing up a number of public buildings. But the British government will not be swayed. With Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin as their main spokesman, they refuse to lift the restrictions on Jewish immigrants which had been in place since before the war. Now the British are not just turning back ships in the Mediterranean, they also close off the land routes, particularly at the start of the main one from Germany and Austria through Italy. This alarms the United States, led by President Harry S. Truman. Having been pressing the British since the end of the war to accept more immigrants, Truman is growing increasingly uneasy at their continuing intransigence. But they refuse to listen. Even previous supporters like Golda Meir now turn against the British. And when, in April 1946, it's announced that the British had leaned on the Italians to prevent two refugee ships setting sail from the port of La Spezia in northwest Italy, Meir suggests that she and 14 other leading Zionists go on hunger strike until the ships, which contain more than 1,000 refugees from Poland and Central Europe, are allowed to leave. Surprisingly, her ploy works, and on May the 8th, the ships are given permission to set sail. But the terrorists are still not satisfied. They're determined to keep up the pressure until the exasperated British agree to leave Palestine. The Irgun, now led by Menachem Begin, plan an outrage which will shock the world. July the 22nd, 1946, Jerusalem, 11:45 a.m. Six men dressed as Arabs arrive at a side entrance to the King David Hotel, the British administration's headquarters in Palestine. A few minutes later, a truck draws up. It's loaded with milk churns. The men, who are in fact members of the Irgun, carry the churns into the hotel and down into the basement. After herding out various hotel workers, they place the churns, each of which contains 50 kilos of high explosive and detonators, around pillars supporting the floors above. But within a few minutes, they're discovered by an unarmed British Army officer. As he walks towards them, he's shot in the stomach. The terrorists then finish setting the charges and leave the hotel by the same side entrance. There, they shoot a police officer who's standing just outside. As they start running away, they're shot at by other soldiers and police officers who've arrived on the scene. An explosion suddenly erupts on the pavement opposite. It's a diversionary tactic, enabling the terrorists to escape in the ensuing confusion. Then, at around 12:36 p.m., the sound of a massive explosion fills the air. Part of the seven-story right wing of the hotel collapses in a heap of rubble. 91 people die in the blast. 28 British, 41 Arabs, 17 Jews, and 5 others. John Colton, the army officer in charge of the rescue operation, recalled the scene.
We had to impose silence from time to time so that we could hear and listen for people who had not been killed screaming so that we could locate them and with any luck dig them out, in which we were not very successful. We dug out 6 people altogether alive. The 6th person was 3 days after we'd started. And we pulled out 91 dead, so that was the scale of the operation. It was huge.
It's the worst attack on the British since they assumed full control of Palestine in 1923. It's also the first major terrorist attack since the end of World War II. In a statement to the House of Commons, Prime Minister Clement Attlee describes it as an insane act of terrorism. 2 days later, the Irgun admit responsibility, claiming they telephoned the British, giving them 22 minutes warning before the bombs went off. This is vehemently denied by the British, and most people tend to believe them rather than the Irgun. Much later, Menachem Begin insisted a proper warning had been given.
None would have been hurt at all, but the evacuation of the hotel was prevented by the man on the spot, and this was the tragedy. We never wanted to cause any casualties during that historic operation.
Edward Horn of the Palestinian police disagreed.
CID had all kinds of joke warnings, malicious warnings of all kinds of events. What was there about this one that made it draw the attention to evacuate the building? the so-called 20-minute warning was not enough, and it wasn't a very good warning.
Although the US administration is as shocked as everyone else by the outrage, it doesn't lessen its pressure on the British to ease up on their immigration policy. President Truman still wants to see 100,000 Jewish refugees allowed into Palestine from Europe during the next few weeks. The British realize that if they want to keep the US on side, they will have to start making some concessions. But for the time being, they want to concentrate on bringing the King David bombers to justice. They set up Operation Shark, the largest search for terrorists ever carried out in Palestine. Launched in Tel Aviv on July the 25th, Operation Shark will involve more than 15,000 troops. Nearly 800 suspects are arrested as the British seal off Tel Aviv from the outside world. They include Yitzhak Shamir, the Stern Gang commander, but not the Irgun leader, Menachem Begin. He manages to evade the authorities. He was, allegedly, saddened by the deaths of so many people in the hotel. Begin's remarks are greeted with cynical disbelief by the British. The bombing of the King David Hotel resulted in a schism between the Irgun and the Haganah, whose leaders were horrified by the outrage. They now sought to distance themselves from the Irgun and the Lehi, knowing that such violence would only harden British resolve. Instead, the Haganah concentrate on smuggling in illegal immigrants and the occasional act of sabotage, such as damaging Royal Navy ships used to keep the refugees at bay. However, the Irgun is determined to continue hitting the British as hard as they can until they give up and withdraw from Palestine. They carry on harassing the security forces, blowing up buildings, mining roads and bridges, attacking police stations and military bases, and derailing trains. But it won't be long before the Irgun stage what has been described as the most spectacular operation carried out against the British during the entire Mandate period. May the 4th, 1947, Acre, 4:10 p.m. A group of Irgun terrorists launch a daring attack on the British-run fortress prison at Acre. Previously thought to be impregnable, the prison is breached through a hole blown in the wall. The attackers force their way inside and, after a series of running gun battles with the guards, release 230 inmates. However, much to their chagrin, only 41 of them were Jews. The rest were Arabs. Several Irgun fighters were killed during the breakout, and a number also taken prisoner. Three would be hanged later, resulting in a shocking reprisal. At the time, the Irgun held two British Army sergeants, kidnapped at the coastal resort of Netanya to the north of Tel Aviv a month earlier. The Irgun hoped to trade their lives for those of the condemned men. They were wrong. So just 13 hours after the prisoners were executed, the two sergeants were put to death in a basement room. They were then strung up in a nearby forest and set with booby traps, one of which badly wounded an army captain as the bodies were cut down. The murder of the two men caused widespread revulsion. Prominent Jewish leaders, including Golda Meir, expressed their deep regret and shame. And the Haganah, now completely removed from the Irgun, described the incident as a most revolting crime. In fact, the Haganah leadership is so appalled that they now join forces with the British in maintaining security around Netanya. They're convinced it's now only a matter of time before the British quit Palestine. And they want to step into the vacuum created by the eventual departure of the troops. Meanwhile, the British are still determined to prevent more Jews arriving. In mid-July 1947, 4,500 refugees are forcibly removed from a ship called the Exodus, escorted into the port of Haifa, and then sent back on three ships bound for France. But the Jews refuse to leave when they arrive. So now the ships sail for Germany, where the Jews are put in displaced persons camps. It will be a year before they reach Palestine again, this time to stay. Back in London, the House of Commons is recalled from its summer recess for an emergency debate on the worsening situation in Palestine. The British are beginning to tire of maintaining order, and the security forces, which now number more than 100,000, seem unable to stem the flow of violence. Then, in November, the United Nations General Assembly, who could see no end to the conflict, recommend that the mandate should be terminated and that Palestine should be divided into two separate states, Palestine for the Arabs and Israel for the Jews. However, the Holy City of Jerusalem, to which both Arabs and Jews laid claim, would be administered separately by the UN. The UN proposes that the British remain in Palestine until the transfer of power, but that this should take place no later than August 1st, 1948. The British government agrees, but then surprises everyone by setting the date even earlier, May the 15th. Meanwhile, the Arabs in Palestine are far from happy with the prospect of partition. They're convinced that when the Jews establish their own state, it will be very much to their detriment. In December 1947, the Arab League meets in Cairo. They reject the UN plan out of hand, preferring a military solution to the never-ending conflict between Arabs and Jews rather than a political settlement. So now, with the creation of Israel just 6 months away, violence between the Jews and Arabs in Palestine erupts almost immediately. There are a number of bloody clashes, but the Haganah plays no part in the random violence. One of its leading members at the time is Yitzhak Rabin. As someone who will later become Prime Minister of Israel twice, he knows that at some point, Arabs and Jews will have to reach an accord with each other. But this is a long way ahead. On May the 14th, 1948, the State of Israel came into being. David Ben-Gurion, the country's first Prime Minister, brought the ceremony a day forward, because May the 15th, the date nominated by the British, was a Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath. And in accordance with their ancient traditions, none of the Jews signing the Declaration of Independence would have been permitted to use a pen on the Sabbath. It would have been regarded as work. The British start leaving on May the 15th, as agreed. Israel is recognized immediately by a great many countries, including the US and the Soviet Union. At the same time, Ben-Gurion invites the Haganah to come in from the cold and form the basis of the country's new army, the Israel Defense Force, or IDF. The Irgun and the remnants of the Lehi, or Stern Gang, are also invited to join. A few do, but most prefer to go it alone. The timing could not have been more propitious, because within a few days, troops from Syria, Jordan, Egypt, the Lebanon, and Iraq invade the newly independent nation. It would not be until January the following year that a peace, of sorts, was declared. Meanwhile, sporadic acts of terrorism continue to impede Israel's progress. The most notable of these occurred in Jerusalem on September the 17th, 1948, when Count Volker Bernadotte, a Swedish diplomat, was ambushed in his car and shot to death. His assassins were members of the Stern Gang. Bernadotte was murdered because the Stern Gang leadership, including Yitzhak Shamir, were furious that in his role as a UN mediator, Bernadotte favored an Arab administration in Jerusalem. The Israeli government was quick to condemn the assassination. Ben-Gurion decides that he would no longer tolerate any underground movements and orders the immediate arrest of all known Stern Gang members. He also clamps down on the Irgun, giving them 24 hours to hand over their weapons and disband. Now he gives them a stark choice: join the IDF or be hunted down and destroyed. In May 2003, 55 years after Israel became an independent state, the British National Archives released a previously top-secret MI5 document headed Present Trends in Palestine. Written in August 1946, it revealed that the Stern Gang planned to set up a cell in London and assassinate Ernest Bevin, Britain's foreign secretary at the time. It's believed that people had already been selected and trained for the mission. But it was called off at the last moment, as the Stern Gang leadership decided to concentrate their activities in Palestine. By May 1948, the terrorists had been absorbed into mainstream Israeli politics. By embracing democracy, previous terrorist leaders have instead become leaders who now speak for their country, which, even today, is still fighting for its existence.